Hello, this is Jane from the Talking Information Center. Today we will be reading from the Wednesday, May 27th, 2026 edition of Reuters News. Trump-backed candidate's landslide in Texas gives Democrats hope in November, by Nolan McCaskill. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton ousted four-term U.S. Senator John Cornyn on Tuesday, riding President Donald Trump's endorsement to a runoff victory for the Republican Senate nomination, U.S. media projected. The race was called shortly after polls closed in Texas's westernmost counties, which are in a separate time zone from most of the state. Without a shadow of a doubt, I will be the Democrats' number one target in November, Paxton said in his victory speech. Texas will be the radical left's number one priority, but we're not going to let them take it. Paxton's win will force Cornyn into retirement early next year, and the Republican political establishment in Washington into embracing a candidate it has long opposed. Cornyn, 74, was backed by Republican leadership in the fight of his political life against Paxton, a 63-year-old scandal-plagued attorney general who won Trump's endorsement last week. Paxton will face Democratic State Representative James Tallarico in a high-profile race that could help decide control of the Senate and may become one of the most expensive in U.S. history. The 37-year-old Democrat is a Presbyterian seminarian and leading fundraiser whose campaign has appealed to independent and moderate voters. Paxton's supporters quickly attacked his past comments about a non-binary God and six biological sexes, with Paxton and the Republican National Committee chairman calling him a Talafrico. Senate Republicans' campaign arm warned in an internal memo last year that a Paxton nomination would hand Democrats an opening to flip Texas and cause Republicans to divert hundreds of millions of dollars that would otherwise be spent winning key battlegrounds. Trump congratulated Paxton in a social media post on Wednesday and promised to hold, quote, some nice, big, beautiful rallies, end quote, for him, writing, Texas, this will be fun. Cornyn told supporters he will back the Republican ticket in November. I've said this throughout this race that I trust the voters of Texas and they made their decision and I must respect it, he said in his concession speech. Republicans hold a 53-47 majority in the Senate over Democrats, who would need to net four seats in November's election to take control of the chamber. Democrats are on defense in two states Trump won in 2024, Georgia and Michigan, but could win the chamber by holding those two seats and flipping North Carolina, Maine, Ohio, and Alaska. A competitive race in Texas, where no Democrat has won statewide since 1994, would expand the party's path to a majority and potentially force Republicans to redirect investments from more competitive battlegrounds to protect their nominee in a state that Trump carried by nearly 14 percentage points in 2024. In backing Paxton, Trump chose loyalty over electability as he continues to flex his iron grip over Republican voters. This month, Trump's endorsement of Republican primary challengers ousted incumbents including Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy and Kentucky Representative Thomas Massie. Paxton was impeached by the Texas House, indicted for felony fraud, reported to the FBI by his top aides, and is being divorced by his wife on biblical grounds, although he has denied any wrongdoing. In a joint statement, Democratic Senators Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand said, Republicans are facing their nightmare scenario, while Democrats move closer to winning the majority. Lauren French, a spokesperson for the Democratic Senate Majority PAC, said Paxton's win was a loss for Washington Republicans, who spent nearly $100 million on Cornyn's behalf. Even members of his own party called Paxton too corrupt and too damaged for Texas. Now he's the GOP standard bearer, she said. Good luck with that. Loyalty trumps electability. Tallarico starts the general election with a three-month head start after defeating U.S. Representative Jasmine Crockett on March 3rd. In a new campaign video released Tuesday night, Tallarico said, "The most corrupt politician in America just became the Republican nominee for United States Senate." Tallarico's initial lead in the opinion polls has evaporated, with the most recent survey showing the race in a dead heat against Paxton, with 8% of likely voters undecided. Cornyn's campaign attacked Paxton's character from the beginning, including calling him Crooked Ken and launching a dating game that allows users to swipe on Paxton's alleged mistresses. Paxton challenged Cornyn to stop the negative ads for the good of our party. "We've already changed our TV ad traffic to ensure our campaign ends on a positive note so that we can focus on beating the leftist lunatic in the fall," Paxton wrote on X last week. House runoffs in several districts. Voters across the state also chose their nominees in more than a dozen congressional districts, including the San Antonio area 35th district, an open seat Democrats are hoping to flip. Trump endorsed U.S. Air Force candidate Carlos de la Cruz, defeated Republican State Representative John LeJohn. The Democrats' preferred candidate also prevailed. Johnny Garcia, a public information officer for Bexar County Sheriff Javier Salazar, beat Maureen Galindo, a fringe candidate who has been widely condemned for anti-Semitic comments. Garcia won despite a Republican-aligned political committee called Lead Left PAC spending nearly $1 million boosting Galindo. U.S. draws up plan to halt immigration. Customs Processing at Sanctuary City Airports, by David Shepherdson. U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen said the Trump administration is drawing up plans to stop processing international travelers and cargo at major U.S. airports in sanctuary cities that have declined to cooperate with an immigration crackdown. The move could effectively halt international air travel and commerce at major airports in Democratic states, with millions of foreign tourists expected to stream in for next month's start of the FIFA World Cup. Mullen told Fox News Channel's Sean Hannity in an interview broadcast on Tuesday that he had met White House officials, but emphasized no decision had been made whether to proceed. We're currently drawing up plans, Mullen said. We shouldn't be processing international flights into their cities, he added, in a reference to sanctuary cities, where he suggested local radical left Democrats aren't allowing us to do our job and enforce federal laws. Last week, Reuters and other media reported that Mullen had privately told U.S. travel executives his department could opt to stop customs and immigration's processing of international travelers. The U.S. Justice Department published a list of so-called sanctuary cities and states that included many cities with major international airports. Among these were Boston, Denver, Philadelphia, Chicago, Los Angeles, New York City, Newark, Seattle, and San Francisco. Mullen first publicly made the threat in April during a dispute over funding for his department, but said on Tuesday the idea was under active consideration. Democrats say reforms are needed to rein in abuses by immigration and customs enforcement and customs and border protection, including the killing of two U.S. citizens in Minneapolis in January. The U.S. Travel Association, which represents major airlines, hotels, car rental firms, and other travel companies, told Reuters on Friday its representatives had met Mullen. Mullen confirmed his previous comments that the administration is considering a withdrawal of customs and border protection officers from international airports in certain sanctuary cities, U.S. Travel added in a statement to Reuters. It also flagged the devastating consequences for the travel industry and communities dependent on international visitors. More than 50 million international travelers arrived at the three major New York airports alone last year. Reducing customs staffing at major airports would disrupt operations significantly for carriers, travelers, and the flow of international cargo. Airlines for America, a grouping of major passenger and cargo airlines, said last week. New York Fed finds remarkable increase in food insecurity for many Americans, by Michael Derby. Food-related challenges are surging for America's least well-off residents, and that likely explains the marked rise in a sour consumer mood, despite data showing the economy is overall doing pretty well, new research from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York says. We find a remarkable increase in food insecurity, particularly among lower-educated and lower-income households and households with young children, bank economists wrote in a blog posting on Wednesday. Mounting food-related issues also track a contemporaneous increase in pessimism among lower-income households and a sharp decline in job-finding expectations. The New York Fed said it had surveyed Americans on whether they had recently used savings to cover expenses, had trouble finding enough food to eat or skipped eating altogether, or had received some form of public or private food assistances. It found that between October of 2025 and February of 2026, there have been meaningful increases in the shares of households reporting facing those conditions. The increases were mostly broad-based across race, age, income, and education groups, but were generally larger for non-whites, lower-income, and lower-educated households, and households with children, the bank economists wrote. The association between food-related challenges and sour consumer sentiment data among lower-income households points to a potential explanation for the unusually low recent levels of consumer sentiment at a time when the hard economic data paint a more positive picture. Divergent prospects. The New York Fed report is the latest set of findings from a series of releases detailing the so-called K-shaped economy, where the economic fates of the wealthy and those who are not have been diverging. The data on food insecurity was derived from the bank's long-running survey of consumer expectations, which is most closely watched for its finding about inflation expectations. Survey respondents were asked specifically about food issues in polls done in 2020, 2025, and in February 2026. Wealthy Americans have been buoyed by rising asset values tied to the stock market, a stable job market, and lower home borrowing costs. Meanwhile, the high inflation pressures that have prevailed since the COVID-19 pandemic have kept pressure on many Americans as key forms of government support have been in retreat. Much of America's current economic strength rests on the spending power of the wealthier economic class. The bottom of the K-shape represents a significant share of the middle and lower income population experiencing elevated levels of economic uncertainty and financial hardship, the bank's report said. Such financial stress is reflected in concerns about affordability due to the high cost of living, persistent inflation and high interest rates, and in high delinquency rates for credit cards and auto and student loans. Pessimism over the economy has emerged as a notable trend in recent months, as inflation pressures have heated up again, driven by President Donald Trump's large-scale import tax increases and his Middle East war that has caused a sizable energy shock, joined with increased uncertainty over the future of the economy. Households have also been stressed by the shift of the job market into a low-hire-low-fire scenario that follows what had been a hot hiring sector during the pandemic and its aftermath. Trump's redistricting push suffers setbacks in Alabama and South Carolina, by Joseph Axe. President Donald Trump's push for Republican-led states to draw electoral maps more favorable to his party ahead of November's midterm elections suffered twin setbacks on Tuesday when efforts in South Carolina and Alabama to reshape U.S. House of Representatives districts were stymied. In a rare break with Trump by members of his own party, several Republican state senators in South Carolina voted with Democrats to abandon a new map aimed at dismantling the U.S. House district held by Congressman James Clyburn, a black Democrat first elected to the seat more than three decades ago. Separately, a panel of three federal judges blocked Alabama Republicans from installing a new map that would eliminate one of the state's two districts with major black populations, ruling that state lawmakers intentionally discriminated against black voters in reconfiguring the boundaries. At Trump's urging, Republicans in several southern states have rushed to implement new maps following a U.S. Supreme Court decision in April that weakened protections for U.S. House districts with significant black or Latino populations. Tennessee already has approved a new map that broke up a majority black Democratic-held district based in Memphis, while Louisiana is advancing a plan to eliminate one of two districts with sizable black populations in that state. Black voters typically support Democrats. Democrats and civil rights advocates have called the Republican moves racially discriminatory. Republican backers have said they're focused on partisan advantage, not race. The effort across the South is part of a national fight over redistricting that Republicans appear to be winning as they seek to retain their narrow U.S. majority in the midterms. Democrats still have hope, with Trump registering low approval ratings in public opinion polls amid the unpopular Iran war and the higher gasoline prices it has caused. South Carolina map fails. South Carolina's proposed map would have positioned Republicans to sweep all seven U.S. House districts in the state after taking apart the district held by Clyburn, 85, a Democratic power broker. Tuesday's vote was the second time that the effort stalled in the state Senate. Five Republicans joined Democrats earlier this month to deny the two-thirds majority needed to advance the plan during a regular session of the chamber. Republican South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster, who previously had rejected White House pressure to call a special session, reversed course and brought lawmakers back to consider the map. The Republican-controlled State House of Representatives passed the map last week. Early voting began in South Carolina on Tuesday in party primaries. Some Republican senators expressed concern that postponing the election might not withstand court challenges. Others said they could not support changing the map and putting off the primaries once ballots had already been cast. As far as I can tell, there is no historical precedent for a legislature to change the date of an election and redraw the maps once voting has begun, Senator Richard Cash said during floor debate. Cash noted that tens of thousands of votes had been recorded by midday. Republicans who voted against the proposed map could face political repercussions, though state senators are not up for re-election until 2028. Several Indiana lawmakers who had rebuffed the president's demand for a new map lost their primaries to Trump-backed challengers this month. Alabama map deemed illegal. In Alabama, a three-judge panel decided that a Republican-backed map intentionally discriminated against black voters and could not be used for the 2026 elections. Instead, the court said, Alabama must continue to use a map that has two districts with sizable black populations, not just one. Republican officials in Alabama immediately said they would appeal to the conservative majority U.S. Supreme Court. Republican Alabama Governor Kay Ivey previously postponed until August the party primaries for four U.S. House districts that were redrawn as part of the disputed map, which was first approved in 2023. The map breaks up a district in which black people comprise just shy of 50% of the population. White people make up about 40% of the district, with other minorities, including Asian and Hispanic people, filling out the balance. Black people make up about a quarter of Alabama's population. The district is currently represented by Congressman Shamari Figures, who is black. The same panel of judges found the map discriminatory in 2023 and blocked it. 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court granted Alabama's request to lift that block and directed the judges to reconsider their findings in light of its April decision that raised the bar for challenging electoral maps on the basis of race. But the panel reached the same conclusion, that the map purposefully and unlawfully targeted black voters. Ultimately, we cannot see our way clear to requiring Alabamians to cast their votes in the 2026 elections under a districting plan tainted by intentional race-based discrimination, wrote the panel, which includes two judges appointed by Trump and one appointed by Democratic former President Bill Clinton. Democrats hold Alabama's two districts with sizable black populations. Republicans control the state's other five districts. Wall Street muted due to Mideast peace deal uncertainty. U.S. stocks were subdued on Wednesday in choppy trading as investors remained cautious while awaiting progress in Middle East talks. Iran's state TV said Tehran had obtained a draft framework for an agreement with the U.S. that would restore Strait of Hormuz shipping within a month in exchange for a U.S. military pullback and lifting of a naval blockade. We're a little bit concerned that the market's going to test once earnings season is over in totality. Then we have a lack of news flow, so the market will turn its attention to the Fed, to the Middle East, said Nancy Tengler, CEO and CIO at Laffer Tenglin Investments. At 9:57 a.m. Eastern Time, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 174.37 points to 50,642 spot 33. The S&P 500 gained 2.37 points to 7,521 spot 49, and the NASDAQ Composite lost 3.30 points to 26,651 spot 99. Six of the 11 main S&P 500 sectors were in the positive territory, with consumer discretionary leading the gains. It was up 1.4%. The S&P 500 Energy Index fell 1.5%. Tracking a decline in oil prices, while tech shares slipped 0.2% after reaching an all-time high on Tuesday. Both the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ had closed at record highs on Tuesday, driven by strong momentum in AI-related stocks as Micron Technology crossed $1 trillion in market cap. Shares of the memory chip maker rose 3.8%. Peers Western Digital and Seagate Technology were up 2.5% and 3.2% respectively. The Philadelphia SE Semiconductor Index was down 0.7%, with chip giant NVIDIA falling 1.7%. A strong earnings season and expectations of about 29% year-on-year growth in the first quarter have aided the rally on Wall Street, with the blue-chip Dow Jones becoming the last major index to hit a record high on Friday. Goldman Sachs raised its 2026 year-end forecast for the S&P 500 to 8,000 from 7,600, citing continued strength in corporate earnings. Markets will next look toward the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index data on Thursday. The Federal Reserve's key inflation measure could provide fresh clues on the monetary policy path forward under the new chair, Kevin Warsh. Money markets currently expect the Fed to keep rates steady for the rest of the year, with some pricing in a 25 basis point hike in December. Among other movers, Zscaler tumbled 30% after the cloud security firm projected fourth quarter revenue below expectations. Global Foundries fell 9% after Bloomberg News reported that majority owner Mubadala Investment Company was seeking to raise $1.91 billion from an unregistered block sale of GFS shares. Bath & Body Works jumped 16.5% after the retailer reported first quarter sales and profit above expectations. Advancing issues outnumbered decliners by a 1.31-to-1 ratio on the New York Stock Exchange and by a 1.15-to-1 ratio on the NASDAQ. The S&P 500 posted 29 new 52-week highs and 5 new lows, while the NASDAQ Composite recorded 106 new highs and 44 new lows. NVIDIA to spend $150 billion a year in Taiwan, the epicenter of AI revolution, says CEO. By Wen Yi Li. From Taipei, NVIDIA's chief executive said on Wednesday the chip company plans to invest around $150 billion a year in Taiwan, terming it the epicenter of the AI revolution and predicting it will be the world's tech manufacturing hub for a long time. 4 years ago, 5 years ago, NVIDIA was spending about $10 or $15 billion a year in Taiwan. Now we're spending $100, going to $150 billion in Taiwan each year. CEO Jensen Huang said at a launch celebration in Taipei for the $5 trillion chipmaker's planned Taiwan headquarters. The project will break ground this year and aims to be operational in 2030, Huang said. He did not provide a time frame for the number of years the company plans to invest $150 billion. The Taiwan headquarters will bring NVIDIA closer to TSMC, the world's largest contract chip maker, which makes many of the advanced semiconductors powering the trend towards AI and is a major supplier to the U.S. tech giant. It will also help the world's most valuable company boost its alliances with other manufacturing partners, including Foxconn, Wistron, and Quanta Computer, which all play key roles in the build-out of AI servers and infrastructure. Taiwan is booming, Huang said on stage to a crowd, including his family, around 1,000 employees, and Taipei Mayor Cheng Wan-an. He said NVIDIA planned to employ 4,000 people at the new site. Taiwan is the epicenter of the AI revolution. This is where the chips come, packaging comes. This is where the systems are made. This is where AI supercomputers were created. The number of partners we work with here in Taiwan, it's incredible. Huang was born in the southern city of Tainan, Taiwan's historic capital, and Wednesday's launch was attended by his parents and his wife, daughter, and son. He emigrated to the United States at the age of 9 and has somewhat of a rock star status in Taiwan, where his every move is closely followed. Earlier this month, Huang was part of the delegation that accompanied U.S. President Donald Trump on a trip to Beijing for a summit with Chinese President Xi Jinping. Taiwan plays a pivotal role in the global AI supply chain for companies, including NVIDIA and Apple, and its position is anchored by TSMC. Underscoring the significance of Taiwan, Advanced Micro Devices said last week it would invest more than $10 billion in Taiwan's AI sector to deepen strategic partnerships and expand its capacity to build and assemble advanced AI chips. NVIDIA made history late last year when it became the first company to reach $5 trillion in market value, cementing its place at the center of the global AI boom. And Huang said on Wednesday it will be worth even more in 3 to 5 years. Last week, NVIDIA aimed to ensure investors that it can keep up its blockbuster growth with the help of a broad base of customers and that new products will help it beat the $1 trillion in sales it has forecast for its flagship AI chips. Senior Ukrainian commander sees imminent turning point in war. By Dan Pelishuk. In the Kharkiv region of Ukraine. Ukraine has a 6-month window in which to seize the battlefield initiative from Russia and strengthen its hand for peace talks, a senior commander told Reuters, predicting a turning point was imminent after more than 4 years of war. Russian forces have made grinding gains since their full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, but the advances have slowed this year and Ukrainian troops are increasing pressure on the battlefield to try to push them back. Brigadier General Andriy Beletsky, who commands Ukraine's 3rd Army Corps, one of Ukraine's most respected fighting forces, told Reuters in an interview that he believes Russia's army is exhausted and incapable of making major breakthroughs. If Ukraine's military can build and maintain momentum over several months, it can gain the initiative along the front line and push Russia to abandon its designs on the last part of the Donetsk region in eastern Ukraine that it does not yet occupy, he said. I believe the next 6 to 9 months are a turning point, Beletsky said, at an undisclosed underground location in the northeastern Kharkiv region. More precisely, I think the next 6 are the most critical, he said. The issue of who controls Donetsk has been a stumbling block in U.S.-backed peace talks that have stalled, with Russia wanting the entire region and Ukraine refusing to withdraw from territory that Moscow's troops have been unable to conquer. We need to define those directions where we can improve our positions, take some strategic points, and then speak with the Russians from a position of strength, not weakness, about a truly stable truce, said Beletsky, a right-wing political leader who founded the battle-hardened Azov Battalion and now commands tens of thousands of troops. From a military point of view, this is realistic. Russia's defense ministry did not immediately respond to a request for comment for this story. Russian President Vladimir Putin has vowed victory in Ukraine and said this month he thinks the war is nearing an end. Critical months ahead. Russia's advances have been complicated by a decision by billionaire Elon Musk to deny Moscow's forces access to his Starlink satellite-based internet service. Kiev has meanwhile stepped up medium-range drone attacks on Russian air defenses and logistics, helping more long-range strikes get through to hit oil and military facilities in Russia. President Vladimir Zelensky said last week Ukraine had retaken nearly 600 square kilometers, the equivalent of 230 square miles, of territory in 2026. Reuters could not independently verify the figure. Moscow currently controls almost one-fifth of the Ukrainian territory. Assessing the military situation, John Helan of the Finland-based Blackbird Conflict Analysis Group echoed Beletsky in saying fatigue was a problem for Russian forces, while Ukraine's war effort is hampered by a manpower shortage. It does seem like 4 or 5 months into this year, it's much more likely that the Russians will get exhausted before the Ukrainian problems come to a breaking point, he told Reuters. On Monday, the U.S.-based Institute for the Study of War said Kiev's forces were now actively challenging the positional character of the war and could soon be capable of staging limited mechanized assaults. Fortress Belt. Russian troops are bearing down on eastern Ukraine's Fortress Belt, where fighting is raging inside the strategic city of Kostyantynivka, its southern end. The constellation of heavily fortified cities anchors Ukrainian defenses. Capturing it would position Russia to threaten the rest of the Donbas. Beletsky, whose forces hold over one-tenth of the total front line, said his troops were firmly holding the flank around Slovyansk, the belt's northern bastion, and forcing Russia to attack the city head-on. Such costly assaults have helped drain Russian forces and led to heavy losses of field commanders, he said, in what he described as a professional degradation of Moscow's military. The lack of personnel no longer allows them to advance the way they did, for example, a year ago, said Beletsky. Beletsky said it was too early to draw conclusions from Kiev's recent success, but that Ukraine could capitalize on it by continuing mid-range attacks and advancing carefully. Moscow is radically losing in battlefield communications because of Musk's crackdown on use of Starlink, Beletsky said. But he described the sides at parity in evolving technology, with Ukraine leading in unmanned ground vehicles, UGVs, and heavy bomber drones, and Russia winning the race for fiber optic drones, which cannot be jammed. A potential blueprint for a modernized Ukrainian army, his corps has led efforts to transform training and integrate new technology, such as UGVs, as an important part of its battlefield strategy. Beletsky's units lead the way in deploying stealthy kamikaze drones and robots armed with machine guns or rocket launchers to replace significant portions of infantrymen, aiming for 30% by 2027, he said. The next revolution will allow commanders to stage more creative combined assault operations while conserving precious troops, Beletsky said. It will happen this year, and I think we'll show how our corps is a vivid example of it, he said. Trump raises refugee ceiling by 10,000 to bring in more white South Africans. By Ted Hessen. U.S. President Donald Trump increased the refugee admissions ceiling by 10,000 this year to allow more white South Africans to come into the country, a signed presidential determination reviewed by Reuters showed. The document, dated May 21st, said white South Africans of Afrikaner ethnicity face an emergency situation due to the, quote, incitement of racially motivated violence, end quote, by the government and political parties in the majority black country. Trump, a Republican, froze refugee admissions from around the world when he took office in January 2025, but weeks later launched a program exclusively aimed at bringing in white South Africans. The effort, which prioritized white refugees while shunning thousands of others from Africa, Asia, and elsewhere, was part of a broader challenging of humanitarian norms around refugee protection. The Trump administration has admitted only 3 non-South African refugees this fiscal year, government figures show. South Africa rejects persecution claims. South African Foreign Ministry spokesperson Crispin Fury, in response to a Reuters request for comment, rejected the assertion that European-descended Afrikaners face danger and discrimination. The assertion that white Afrikaners in particular endure systemic persecution is entirely without foundation, Fury told Reuters in a statement. The White House document did not list specific examples of South Africa's government allegedly inciting racial violence. A State Department spokesperson declined to confirm the 10,000-person increase to the refugee cap, but said the program was a Trump priority and that the president would determine refugee levels. Trump initially set the refugee ceiling at a record low, 7,500 for fiscal year 2026, which ends on September 30th. But his administration had already brought in 6,000 white South Africans through the end of April, government figures show. Trump's decision to increase the number of refugee admissions brings the total ceiling to 17,500. Reuters first reported the planned refugee program expansion in April. Refugee program proceeds despite tensions. During the apartheid era, which ended with the first democratic elections in 1994, South Africa maintained a racially segregated society with separate schools, neighborhoods, and public facilities for people classified as black, white, Asian, or colored, a term for certain mixed-race people in South Africa. Blacks make up 81% of South Africa's population, according to 2022 census data. Afrikaners and other white South Africans constitute 7% of the population. Tensions over the Trump-led refugee effort flared up in December after South African authorities raided a building in Johannesburg where U.S. staff and contractors were processing refugee cases. After diplomats from both nations held a meeting weeks later, South Africa affirmed that it would allow the U.S. program to continue operating, Reuters reported at the time. In Trump's presidential determination expanding the program, he cites new disruptions of refugee operations in South Africa as contributing to the urgent need to bring in more Afrikaners. To emphasize the program, the Trump administration is interested in bringing white South African refugees to the White House for World Refugee Day on June 20th, according to a U.S. official and internal government email reviewed by Reuters. Commentary by John Morrison. How sustainability can emerge stronger from the environmental, social, and governance pushback. The pushback against sustainability has surprised many, but it should not have. Banks have walked away from the Net Zero Banking Alliance, which itself voted to disband in October 2025. The European Union has pulled back the scope of its corporate sustainability due diligence directive and due diligence legislation. More than 480 anti-ESG bills have been filed in the U.S. state legislatures since 2021, with over 50 enacted. The world is on course to deliver only about 35% of the milestones agreed to under the 2015 through 30 Sustainable Development Goals. It is tempting to read this as an external assault on a sound enterprise. It is more honest to read it as a violent correction and to acknowledge that those of us who work in sustainability have, in different ways, been complicit in allowing sustainability intent to drift so far ahead of delivery. This arbitrage has allowed some businesses and political leaders to cynically short sustainability, both metaphorically and sometimes literally. The pushback against sustainable was inevitable, perhaps a sign of sustainability's growing potency, but its severity has been partly self-inflicted. Three forms of our complicity stand out. The first is the notorious ESG problem, as Vasuki Shastri has named it. ESG began as a narrow tool to help investors price environmental, social, and governance risk into returns. We then let it expand with little resistance into a stand-in for sustainability itself. ESG as input, information that improves a decision, and ESG as output, a claim about real-world performance, are very different things, and we conflated them. The result was a target so broad anyone could hit it, and so loosely defined it could be dismissed as woke capitalism by anyone who wished to. It was a gift to our critics that we did not have to provide. The second is the gap between commitment and delivery. Sustainability pledges have routinely been made by teams that do not control capital allocation, operational priorities, or delivery timelines. Ambition was decoupled from capability. Statements moved faster than systems. Once that gap opens, organizations get trapped in a cycle of escalation. Correction feels like retreat, qualification feels like failure, and each year's communications must sustain a claim whose internal credibility is already weakening. Greenwashing is the visible end of that pattern. Green hushing, the retreat into silence, is the next stage, and no more durable. The third form of our complicity is ignoring place-based realities. The sustainability profession is broadly urban, well-educated, and global by instinct. The impacts of transitions are felt locally, and the politics that follow are local too. Farmers in India and Europe, working communities in steel towns and energy regions, have watched their livelihoods become bargaining chips in negotiations conducted somewhere else. Concerns about jobs, cost, and peace are not climate denial. They are the lived experience of people being asked to bear costs whose benefits are described in technical language by people they have never met. Those opposed to action have proved much better at place-based politics than those advocating for it. None of this is the whole story of the pushback. Genuine bad faith actors are exploiting the moment. But the bubble was real, the failure to deliver was real, and the complacency was real. The question now is, where do we go from here? The answer is not retreat, nor a search for ever more comprehensive frameworks. It is operational repositioning. Sustainability endures only when it sits at what I call bedrock, embedded where capital is allocated, risk is priced, supply chains are designed, and losses are realized. A sustainability issue reaches bedrock when it can no longer be deferred, delegated, or externalized without undermining the stability of the system itself. At that level, trade-offs must be made explicit. Costs must be carried, and responsibility cannot be displaced. An organization that has remade sustainability can be recognized not by its commitments, but by its behavior under constraint. Four arenas are already at bedrock. Finance. Banks can leave alliances, but they cannot leave the loan books in which climate risk is now embedded in stress tests, models, and supervisory expectations. Value chains. Critical minerals, water, food, and energy security have made supply systems contested rather than abstract. And voluntary standards cannot resolve the trade-offs. Leadership. Sustainability becomes real when the trade-offs move from the chief sustainability officer into the hands of the CEO, the CFO, the COO, and the CTO, who must own them. Legitimacy. The social license to implement is earned through visible, repeated decisions that are difficult, consistently applied, and felt as fair by those who bear their consequences. The future will not be tidy. We are living through what Antonio Gramsci called a time of monsters. where old frameworks no longer command confidence and new ones struggle to establish legitimacy. Living with monsters means designing systems that adapt gracefully rather than fall catastrophically, organizations that can reconfigure rather than freeze, and cultures that reward learning rather than denial. Sustainability will be stronger after this pushback than before it. It will be stronger because it will be harder, more operational, and more earned. The question now is how we use the opportunity of the pushback to push back. U.S. antitrust regulators poised to approve Paramount's takeover of Warner Brothers, Semaphore reports. U.S. antitrust regulators appear ready to approve Paramount's $110 billion takeover of Warner Brothers Discovery after a two-hour meeting at the Justice Department, Semaphore reported on Tuesday, citing people familiar with the matter. At the meeting, Paramount CEO David Ellison reiterated a commitment to releasing movies in theaters, the report said. According to the report, the Department of Justice staff attorneys seem swayed by arguments from top Paramount executives that the deal would not hurt other studios and creative talent. Reuters could not immediately verify the report. The DOJ, Paramount, and Warner Brothers did not immediately respond to requests for comment outside regular business hours. Hollywood and Wall Street are intensely interested in the high-stakes deal, which would bring together some of the entertainment industry's most enduring franchises, but could hurt film and television jobs. The DOJ in March sent subpoenas in its investigation of Paramount's acquisition of Warner Brothers, seeking information on how the deal would affect studio output, content rights, competition among streaming services, and how the acquisition could affect movie theaters. Top Hollywood stars have also opposed the merger. Jane Fonda, J.J. Abrams, and Mark Ruffalo are among the nearly 3,500 signatories to a letter that argued the combination would lead to fewer opportunities for creators, job losses, and higher costs for consumers. Paramount pushed hard to take the deal away from Netflix and has bet on closing it quickly, pledging to pay Warner Brothers shareholders a quarterly ticking fee of 25 cents per share starting in October if the deal has not closed by then. Republican attorneys general split with House party members over U.S. social media bill by Courtney Rosen. More than a dozen Republican attorneys general said they oppose a children's online safety bill backed by their party's members of the U.S. House of Representatives, according to a letter released on Tuesday, exposing a Republican rift over how to keep kids safe online. The attorneys general urged Congress not to pass the Kids Internet and Digital Safety Act, a bill that would require social media platforms such as TikTok and Meta to provide parental controls and curtail their collection of minors' data. The Republican attorneys general opposed the bill because it would limit states' power to pass their own laws regulating social media, according to the letter. The bill not only fails to meaningfully protect kids, but also imperils the significant progress our jurisdictions have achieved on a wide array of tech issues, the attorneys general wrote. The letter demonstrates growing divisions in the Republican Party about social media regulation. On one side is the group of attorneys general and senators such as Marsha Blackburn and Ted Cruz, who say they want social media platforms to take more responsibility if they contribute to a range of harms to minors, including eating disorders and depression. On the other side are Republicans such as House Energy and Commerce Chairman Brett Guthrie, who has said that a more expansive bill could face court challenges. Dozens of Democratic attorneys general also signed the letter. The list of Republican signatories includes Republican attorneys general from Tennessee, Alabama, and Utah, all states that have passed bills regulating screen time for minors. Trump's domestic shipping waiver has not cut gasoline prices by much, data shows. From Houston, President Donald Trump's waivers allowing foreign-flagged ships to move oil and fuel between U.S. ports have had little impact on high domestic gasoline prices due to elevated shipping rates and the relatively small fuel volumes transported so far, a Reuters analysis found. In March, Trump issued a waiver to the Jones Act, a century-old law that requires shippers to use vessels built, owned, and crewed by Americans to transport commodities between U.S. ports. The policy, aimed at supporting the domestic maritime industry and national security, has also resulted in higher shipping costs within the U.S. Trump waived the act to facilitate fuel transport around the U.S. coastline, primarily from Gulf Coast refiners to the East and West Coasts, regions that rely on imports due to insufficient local refineries and pipeline connections to meet demand. The waiver represents the broadest suspension of the Jones Act in its history and offers a real-world test of whether easing the restrictions can reduce fuel transportation costs. Gasoline prices have spiked higher since the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran began in late February, and the waiver is one of several measures Trump has taken to try to control fuel prices, which are feeding inflation. Pain at the pump could hurt Republicans campaigning to retain control of Congress in November's midterm elections. National gasoline prices averaged $4.49 per gallon on Tuesday, according to AAA, compared to under $3 before the war. California prices averaged $6.11 per gallon. This waiver is not delivering on what Trump was told it would do, lower prices at the pump and materially increase the flow of product across the country, said Jennifer Carpenter, president of the Pro-Jones Act group American Maritime Partnership. The White House said data compiled since the initial Jones Act waiver showed that significantly more supply was able to reach U.S. ports faster. Administration officials are pleased with the waiver's results and have told the oil industry they are open to further extensions if conditions require it, two sources said. During the first 2 months of the waiver, refiners including Valero and Phillips 66 used the exemption about 50 times, moving 2.6 million barrels of crude and 7.5 million barrels of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel, federal data showed. These volumes were only a fraction of daily U.S. consumption, and rates for available foreign flag tankers were high because many ships were trapped inside the Strait of Hormuz. Freight rates are much, much higher than they typically would be, said Ryan Kellogg, an energy policy professor at the University of Chicago. International vessels were just really hard to get to. Jones Act critics say the law creates inefficiencies and that the use of international ships under the waiver signaled demands for more tankers. The fact that waivers have been used 50 times to move energy suggests that this was the best option, and if this didn't exist, a more expensive, costlier option would have had to be used, said Colin Grabow at the conservative think tank Cato Institute, which has long called for the Jones Act law to be repealed. California, the nation's top oil and fuel importer, received over 60% of gasoline and blend stock cargoes moved under the waivers, about 3 million barrels or 2.1 million gallons a day. That is roughly just 6% of the 36 million gallons Californians consume daily. Foreign vessels also carried gasoline to Alaska, Florida, South Carolina, and Oregon, data showed. Combined, shipments totaled around 84,000 barrels per day, a fraction of the 8.75 million barrels consumed daily nationwide. Shipping on an international vessel from the U.S. Gulf Coast to the West Coast would have saved about 6.6 cents a gallon, or 1% of California's current prices, compared with a Jones Act tanker, according to price reporting firm Argus. On the East Coast, high demand for foreign ships to Asia meant it was actually cheaper to ship on a Jones Act tanker. As international tanker rates fall, companies are likely to use the waivers more in coming weeks, industry experts said. The waiver also appeared to reshape shipping patterns, raising concerns about tight U.S. tanker markets. At least one U.S. tanker shipped Alaskan crude to South Korea in April, its first recorded international voyage since 2014. Valero recently sought a Jones Act tanker to move fuel to Mexico, two sources said. Industry sources said that could be an unintended consequence of the waiver. If foreign vessels undercut domestic routes, more U.S. ships could pursue international business, straining domestic tanker availability. Tax uncertainty over waiver voyages also deterred companies from chartering foreign tankers for U.S. routes, a shipping source said. U.S. mortgage rate rises to 9-month high. The rate on the most popular U.S. home loan rose to a 9-month high last week as the Iran war kept oil prices elevated, fueling inflation concerns and pushing benchmark U.S. Treasury yields higher. The average 30-year fixed-rate mortgage rose 9 basis points to 6.65% in the week ended May 22nd. The Mortgage Bankers Association said on Wednesday. It was last higher in August of 2025 before the Federal Reserve began a series of interest rate cuts to head off further labor market weakening. The U.S. labor market has since stabilized, with the unemployment rate now at the same 4.3% it was last August. Meanwhile, inflation has picked up, with consumer prices rising 3.8% in April from a year earlier, compared with 2.9% in August. Worried that the increase is not just due to a temporary rise in energy prices, but could be more persistent, a growing number of Fed policymakers say they may need to consider raising the interest rates. Mortgage applications dropped 8.5% from a week earlier, the MBA said, driven largely by a decline in refinancing. The latest rise in mortgage rates came as Kevin Warsh took over as the Federal Reserve's new chair, succeeding Jerome Powell, whom President Donald Trump had criticized tirelessly for keeping interest rates too high. Hours after Warsh was sworn in at a White House ceremony, Trump said he expected rates to come down. In contrast, financial markets are now pricing in the possibility of a Fed rate hike by year's end.